I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The Reading Railroad Viaduct that runs through the Callow Hill and Chinatown North neighborhoods in Philadelphia has fallen into disrepair after being abandoned. Now there are some plans to turn it into a park, modeled in part on the successful High Line in Manhattan. But this being Philadelphia, not everyone is on board. Some residents in Chinatown would rather see money invested in low-income housing. City Council authorized a neighborhood improvement district, also called a NID, for this community, with a special property tax assessment to generate money for projects. It has also generated some conflict. Isaiah Thompson has been covering the story for the Philadelphia City Paper, where he's an investigative reporter and a columnist, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Isaiah, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, I'm very happy to be here.
Nice to have you here. Let's talk about where this viaduct is. And this is, a storied railroad, the Reading Railroad, used to be where commuters would come into the city. What does it look like now?
Well, right now it's a big, elevated, abandoned railroad. It's a bunch of really high weeds up there, and I have climbed up there, which is not legal, but I went up there anyway for check it out for a story I was working on. It's a really interesting, elevated open space. There's really neat views of the city. It kind of takes you through these interesting back corridors of the city. You see stuff you've never seen before. It's pretty decrepit. There's good reasons not to go up there. But the idea of making it into a park is very intriguing.
Indeed it is. And we're talking about, again, to orient our listeners, the Callow Hill, North Chinatown neighborhood.
Yeah, so this is east of Broad Street, west of 8th Street. And the railroad actually is kind of like a V that comes in from the east, and then it sort of goes north up to, I believe, just short of Spring Garden Street.
And how would you describe the neighborhood? And I'm not sure it exactly bisects this neighborhood, but nonetheless, we've got several neighborhoods coming together.
Yeah, it sort of awkwardly chops the neighborhood. It's a funny shape, but the neighborhood is pretty run down. It's been an industrial district for a long time, and so you've got a lot of warehouses and a lot of kind of small industry in that neighborhood. The neighborhood is pretty run down. It's the site of, I believe, I want to say, three homeless shelters, one of which is going to close soon, the Ridge Shelter for men. So it's definitely a neighborhood that's somewhat run down, but it's also got a lot of very interesting architecture and an interesting mix of people there. And it's obviously got, on the north side, it's got this kind of newer condo loft district that, you know, has seen a lot of new energy recently.
And on the other side, you have what is Chinatown, or certainly North Chinatown.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of the businesses on that part, this is sort of the south part of the neighborhood, north of Vine Street, there's a lot of businesses that are related to Chinatown proper and support Chinatown proper. And there's a lot of Asian American businesses there.
Well, let's talk about something called the Neighborhood Improvement District. We were joking back and forth about this acronym NID, but that's what it's called.
A neighborhood. Yeah, I've promised not to say NID for half an hour.
And I just did. But nonetheless, what is a NID?
Well, I mean, the basic idea is a neighborhood, with the support of City Council. City Council can charter this sort of Neighborhood Improvement District, which is a special tax or assessment on real estate for that neighborhood, and the funds that are collected go back into that neighborhood, and the funds are overseen by a board of directors that comes from within that neighborhood.
And we're talking about in this particular neighborhood, a 7% property assessment tax.
Yeah, that's right.
Are there other NIDs in Philadelphia?
There are other BIDs, which, yeah, and I'm not supposed to say NID, and now I'm saying BID. But yeah, there are business improvement districts. I believe, I may be wrong, but I'm pretty sure this is the first residential neighborhood improvement district, at least of this kind. There are a lot of business improvement districts around, mostly around kind of attractions. Sort of, there's a South Street improvement district, there's an Old City improvement district, there's a Center City improvement district. And I know that there's one up in Germantown. I believe that's also a business improvement district. So this would be the first one that would really, you know, tax or impose this assessment on a whole residential neighborhood.
With the idea of investing that money in that neighborhood on improvement projects.
Yeah, that's right. It's basically a neighborhood. The idea is it's a neighborhood or an area deciding, hey, we want to pay a little extra so that we can do more stuff in this neighborhood.
And why has this neighborhood improvement district generated such conflict in this particular neighborhood?
Excuse me. Well, it's generated conflict because not everyone in the neighborhood wants it. Not everyone in the neighborhood thinks that it's an appropriate burden. And, you know, we've had a number of real estate hikes in the last couple of years, and there are a number of people in this neighborhood who don't want another one.
And I'm going to...
Excuse me.
That's okay. Take a little drink of water there. But I am curious about whether, and there seems to be some confusion, even some confusion on my part, whether the money from this improvement property tax would be actually used for the viaduct or not.
Yeah, and it's a confusing question. I mean, the origin of this improvement district, as far as I can make out of my reporting, was... that Mr. Paul Levy, who's the head of the Center City District, and he's a guy who's involved in all kinds of stuff in the city, he had sort of proposed this idea to a group of people who were interested in the Reading Viaduct Park a while back. And he proposed this. He had observed that the High Line Park in New York ran into some financial troubles when it was built, and some of the people who had been behind the construction of that wanted to be able to create a similar improvement district in New York and weren't able to. They couldn't get the neighborhood on board. So what Mr. Levy sort of proposed originally was, let's create this thing now up front, and that will help us get funding for this project. When I say we, he's been sort of helping out and supporting the people who are in favor of this park. And Center City District has actually commissioned some studies of it. So that was the origin of it, but because of the controversy around it, wording that, you know, that in the bill that would create this thing has been removed that says that the funds would go toward the Reading Viaduct Park.
Right. But it sounds like there's still some leftover, if not suspicion, belief that it would be. And I'm quoting Councilman DiCicco. This is his district, saying much of the information suggests that this NID has been created either for the sole purpose or partial purpose of funding the viaduct. And he says nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah, it's a confusing situation. I mean, it may not be true anymore, but it was true. And so the people who are pointing this out, they're not sort of getting this from nowhere. And, you know, it should also be pointed out that the people who are pushing for the Neighborhood Improvement District right now, not all of them, but some of them, like Mr. Struble, who will be on later, and others, that, you know, they are also the people who've been really trying to get this park created for a long time. Now, that's not true for all. I know there are other people who are in favor of this improvement district, who are not necessarily that interested in the park. So I don't want to paint with too wide a brush there. But, yeah.
But it does appear that there is an organization within Chinatown, a business organization, that is opposed to this improvement district. But I'm not sure whether they're opposed to the viaduct.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether they're opposed to the viaduct either. I think... in some ways, I do think that the park, the viaduct park idea, has become it's a bit of a red herring, I think, because I don't see that anyone is adamantly opposed to having this park, although there are some complicated issues. I mean, let's say it gets built. It'll take a while. You know, it likely will raise property values if that happens, and I think that will affect a lot of people positively, and it will affect some people negatively, particularly low-income people who want to stay in the neighborhood. But I don't think that the viaduct is really at the heart of the issue. I think the heart of the issue is some people don't want to pay an additional tax to a group that they feel does not represent them. That's,
now,
you know.
Now, my understanding is that some of these blocks within this district have been excluded between 8th and 10th and Vine and Callow Hill. So they would not be assessed the way other properties would be in this district, yes?
Well, yes. So Councilman DiCicco, after the first, or during, I think, the first contentious hearing on this bill, kind of cut out this square, which it's a small square, but it incorporates, I'm going to mess up, I want to say Hing Hua, but I'm probably wrong, but it's
someone might call and correct you. But
I hope they do. But yeah, and this is a housing community that was developed by the Philadelphia Chinatown PCDC Development Corporation, and has a lot of Asian Americans and a lot of seniors living there who had strongly objected to paying. So Councilman DiCicco cut out this kind of square. Now there's. The one way to look at it is the way the councilman has portrayed it. He said, look, you didn't want to be in, so I've cut you out. Another way to look at it is there is a serious effort underway to collect 51% of the addresses that would be part of this, or 51% of the total sort of value being assessed. That can overturn this whole thing, even if it passes through council. And there's an effort to collect those signatures. Well, by cutting out that square, a lot of signatures got cut out, too.
Oh.
And I think that what some of the people who oppose this tax would say, who especially Asian Americans and people whose ties are to Chinatown, they would say, look, our community doesn't end, you know, outside of this square. It's to some extent an arbitrary geographical boundary.
So where does this stand? There's a 45-day period where people can write in or address council on their support or criticism of this plan.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the period is. Hopefully someone can call in and fill in that gap. But yeah, there's some period and they need to collect 51%, you know, they need to basically show that a majority of the addresses or a majority of the sort of total property value is opposed to this, and that will in theory sort of cancel this whole thing.
And 51% would cancel the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I believe they're close. So this is pretty pretty contentious.
I'm assuming you've interviewed people that have lived in this neighborhood. Is this a passionate issue for this part of Philadelphia?
It's a very passionate issue. Yeah, I mean, for people who are in favor of this, you know, they see it as they want to be able to contribute a little bit more, and get a lot more out of it. They see a lot of blight in the neighborhood, and they feel like this is a great opportunity to, you know, take on some of the stuff themselves instead of waiting for the city to get around to it, whether the city ever would or could. For the people opposed to it, this is also a passionate issue. I mean, you know, the residents of Chinatown and around Chinatown have had a lot of stuff put on them that they didn't want.
And that would be the convention center, I guess.
A convention center. There was an attempt to build a stadium there. There was the attempt to move Foxwoods Casino there. You know, that was highly contentious. There was the Vine Street Expressway itself, which really, you know, cut off Chinatown from that area north of it. So, you know, there's a long history for those people of having other people's ideas put on them. And I think that they feel that this is another example. Some of them do, at least.
Well, let's
not all of them.
I hear you. Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. And we have two guests we're going to welcome to the conversation. We are talking about a plan, an idea to take the Redding Viaduct, which runs through the North Chinatown and Callow Hill district here in Philadelphia, and turn that into a park. Isaiah Thompson has been writing about this for the Philadelphia City Paper, where he's a reporter and a columnist. John Struble waiting in the wings, and we also have Joshua David, and we've got open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts presents the Gay Theatre of Dublin, performing two new adaptations of Samuel Beckett's Endgame and Watt, featuring the leading Beckett interpreter Barry McGovern, November 8th through 10th at the Annenberg Center. Tickets for Endgame and Watt at 215-898-3900 or annenbergcenter.org. The Gay Theatre of Dublin, November 8th through 10th at the Annenberg Center. The Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts supports WHYY.
Picky eaters, hectic schedules, rising grocery prices, many families struggle to make meals that fit their budgets, tastes, and lives, and are healthy to boot. I'm Mike and Scott. Join us for the next WHYY Parenting Seminar, when we'll discuss healthy nutrition for kids and families. We'll also talk about cooking with children, Tuesday, November 8th at 6:30 here at WHYY. To register, visit whyy.org/member experience.
Drexel University Online supports WHYY and offers over 100 online degrees for those thinking about sharpening work skills or advancing their career. With a focus on practical learning and faculty committed to excellence in education, Drexel offers online master's degrees in library science and post-master's degrees in archival studies, digital libraries, youth services, and more. To learn more about earning a master's, bachelor's, or a certificate, it's Drexel.com. To request more information, Drexel.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Abandoned elevated railroad tracks have been seen as an eyesore until recently. Now more and more people are thinking that these are places that can be turned into urban parks, and the inspiration for this new thinking is the High Line in Manhattan, considered a real success story. Joining us is Joshua David, and he, along with Robert Hammond, co-founded Friends of the High Line back in 1999, and they have co-authored a book about how the High Line came to be, called The High Line, the inside story of New York City's park in the sky. And Josh David, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. It's a real pleasure to be with you this morning.
Nice to have you with us as well. And I should add that there are people looking to do something similar with the Reading Railroad Viaduct here in Philadelphia. And one of those people is John Strubel. He's a furniture maker, has lived in Philadelphia since 1997, a founding member of the Callow Hill Neighborhood Association, and co-founder of the Reading Viaduct Project. And John Strubel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be here. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning, John.
And I should say that Isaiah Thompson's staying with us for the rest of the hour, and we have calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. John, if I can begin with you, as you looked at the Reading Viaduct, what do you see?
At the present time, I see a blighted, elevated railroad tracks, much like Josh saw in the 90s and the early part of the last 10 years before they developed their park. I think I see it as something with a great potential and something that needs a lot of attention.
And when did you come to the conclusion that this could be a good park?
I think about we started our organization in 2003. Actually, it was because Josh came down from New York and gave us the talk at the Horticulture Society and talked about the High Line and what they were doing up there. And because of that, myself and Sarah McEnany created the Reading Viaduct Project, which is a grassroots neighborhood organization to promote and advocate for the city to take over the viaduct.
Josh, let me go back to you. And I've been to the High Line in New York, and it is a marvel, I have to say. And I know that you lived in that neighborhood before, while the High Line was essentially abandoned. When did you begin to look at this sort of empty railroad tracks and think that there was a possibility there?
I lived in the neighborhood for almost 15 years before Robert and I met at a community board meeting and started Friends of the High Line. It was threatened with demolition at that time. I think the threat against it was far greater than what the Reading Viaduct now faces. I think it was a similar thing to what John and Sarah have experienced. It's seeing this feature of your neighborhood that offers an incredible opportunity, and it's an opportunity that just can't be found anywhere else. That's what we saw in the High Line. It connects 22 blocks, goes through two different neighborhoods, and it's an opportunity to see New York City in a way that you just can't see it otherwise. And I think there's a lot of similarity between that opportunity and the opportunity presented by the Reading Viaduct. In fact, the Reading Viaduct in some ways is a greater opportunity than the High Line, in that it's much wider and offers you, I think, a lot more potential for different kinds of development as a park.
But what's interesting, Josh, is you're not an urban planner. You were a magazine writer at the time.
That's correct. Both Robert and I had no relevant experience when we started Friends of the High Line. I was a writer. Robert's an artist and a consultant for internet-based startups. But I think that really served us. It meant that we brought a lot of people in around us who were experts in their fields. We really just raised the flag, and people really rallied around us. So it's similar to what John and Sarah are doing in that it's a very community-based effort that needed to come up and build consensus and get government support before before it could really go forward.
John, do you feel having, I don't know whether you feel like you have no relevant experience, as Josh was just saying, but you and other artists are interested in this viaduct in Philadelphia.
Oh, yes, of course. And you're correct. None of us have any relevant experience. But the good part of that, like Josh says, is that you get involved and you learn. We like to think of ourselves as fairly quick learners. And it is the kind of thing that the Reading Viaduct is the kind of thing that people do rally behind. And we have gotten a considerable amount of support and ideas from a lot of different people.
Josh, let me go back to you. I believe you were listening in as Isaiah was talking about some of the conflicts within this neighborhood, and I'm curious about the kind of conflicts that you face in Manhattan.
It was interesting listening into that conversation. I don't know that much about the politics of the Reading Viaduct neighborhood, but I do. It did bring back so many of the same issues that we encountered as we were bringing the High Line forward, particularly the concern around affordable housing, which was a real priority when we were developing the High Line project. And I think it's important to realize when you're pursuing a project like this that there are 100 different challenges, there are 1,000 different ways that you can object to it, but ultimately, if you look at the central vision of it, the central vision is compelling enough that you figure out a way to work out all of these challenges. And in the case of the High Line, the creation of affordable housing was one of the big challenges. How do you make sure that the creation of this park that does increase property values doesn't only produce high-end residential opportunities? And that's where I think the government really plays a central role. And in our case, it was the City of New York and the leadership of then council member, now Speaker Christine Quinn, who ensured that a requisite amount of affordable housing was mandatory in the plan for the development of the neighborhood around the High Line.
John, let me go back to you. And Isaiah was talking again about some of the conflicts in the neighborhood. This is a neighborhood that you live in. And one of the groups that is concerned about this is the Philadelphia Chinatown Development Corporation. What's your response to their concerns?
We reached out to them quite a lot early on in this, and I think there is room. You know, we support their advocacy of affordable housing, but also our neighborhood is about 45 to 50 acres, and the viaduct is only 3 of those acres. So I think there's 25 to 30% of the area is vacant lots right now, or vacant buildings. So I think there's plenty of room to build their affordable housing, but I just would have them look somewhere else besides the viaduct.
But have you had conversations with them?
Considerable. Yeah, we have been more on the same page in the past than it may appear right now. I mean, we're going to a meeting tonight where they're presenting something that they planned a long time to build at their community center, which we're very much in support of. And we worked with them to oppose the work against the stadium when Mayor Street wanted to build a stadium here in this neighborhood. So we get along with them quite well. There's other people, other spokespersons. There's American Asians, Asian Americans United. There's also the Asian Arts Initiative that are spokespeople for the Chinatown community.
Isaiah, looks like you want to get back in on the conversation. Go ahead.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I think that there's Mr. Struble is right in that actually the Center City District is one of the studies they've been working on is they've been looking at different affordable housing options as part of the park project. And I know that Philadelphia Chinatown Development Corporation has seen some of those ideas, and some of those ideas came from Philadelphia Chinatown. So I think that Mr. Struble is right that it does seem like there's a variety of options within even constructing this park that might include affordable housing. And I think that the Chinatown folks would agree with that. Again, I think that the real issue is not either the park or not the park, or either the park or affordable housing. I think at least right now the most pressing issue is this tax, this assessment. That's really the greatest point of controversy.
And John, if you can weigh in on that, and I mean, do you see a connection between this tax and the viaduct, or is that, in a sense, there is no connection there?
I don't think there's really any connection. When you set up a NID or a BID in the city of Philadelphia, which there are 15 of already, you have to set out a five-year budget plan. And in that budget, it spells out very specifically how the money is spent, and none of that money is spent on the viaduct. The money is spent under the viaduct in the neighborhood, and it's so the question then becomes, who, you know, whether you want or don't want the 7% assessment.
Let me turn to you, Josh. And actually, I'm opening your book about the High Line, and I love this section. A guy named Peter Oblitz. Mm-hmm. He's a Chelsea resident, and I'm just quoting here. Activists and railroad enthusiasts challenged demolition efforts in the 1980s, eventually purchased the High Line from Conrail for $10. go ahead. Tell us a little bit about Peter.
Peter was really the original Save the High Line guy, and he started back in the early 80s, shortly after trains stopped running on the High Line, and he was a railroad enthusiast, and his vision to begin with was really to reactivate rail on the line. And rail, you know, things involving railroads are all subject to these very arcane federal regulations, and one of them allowed bidding by other railroads if there was a chance to turn a line over, and he entered into that bidding process, and nobody else bid, so he got it for $10. But it was later overturned because it was found he didn't have the money to run a railroad. He's since passed away, but we really look to him as the original Save the High Line activist.
Well, also, then Mayor Giuliani wanted to demolish the High Line. Yes,
that's correct. There was basically a coalition between major property owners in the High Line neighborhood. It's an unusual scenario in that this rail easement goes over private property. So these private property owners had lobbied the Giuliani administration once the train stopped running to force the railroad to demolish the High Line so that they could access the development rights that were up above it.
And was it Mayor Bloomberg that prevented that?
Ultimately, the Giuliani administration actually committed the city to the demolition of the High Line, and we had to sue them in court, and we won that suit in the first round. And then Mayor Bloomberg came in early 2002 and gave us an opportunity to argue our case. And one of the central things that we looked at was the economic benefit that building a park on the High Line would create for the neighborhood. Historically, people tend to look at structures like this as a blight. They see a neglected industrial structure and they say that's a blight. And so that was the very commonplace way of looking at it. But we turned that on its head and said, if you look at what you could do up here, it could be an extraordinary engine for economic growth. And we began to put numbers to that and presented an economic feasibility study to the mayor in late 2002, which ultimately helped the Bloomberg administration decide to establish a new policy in favor of reusing the High Line.
And what has it meant for the city, do you think, money-wise?
It's been incredible. I mean, it's far in many different ways, this is far beyond anything that we ever imagined for it. And this is where I'll diverge for a moment and say my thoughts on the Philadelphia project. There's so many, you can come up with a zillion different reasons not to do something like this. But I think it's really important to remember to focus on the reasons to do something like this. In the case of the High Line, the city's estimated that it's created about $2 billion in new investment around the High Line since 2005, since the project was approved. And since we've opened, we've had millions of visitors a year. We were 2.2 million visitors last year. We think we're going to be over 3 million visitors this year. And it's had just an incredibly positive effect on local businesses and the economic vibrancy of the neighborhood.
And, of course, you have that hotel that straddles the High Line.
Indeed. But
and I don't know if people are still forgetting to pull the curtains there or not.
Yep.
But
I think that was always the story was never quite as big as what people made of it. I've been under it thousands of times, and I've never seen anything happening up there, but others have.
And that's Joshua David, co-founded Friends of the High Line in Manhattan back in 1999. The High Line has been built. Two sections of the High Line have been built, and he has co-authored with Robert Hammond a book about it called High Line, The Inside Story of New York's Park in the Sky. John Struble is a furniture maker here in Philadelphia and a founding member of the Callow Hill Neighborhood Association, co-founder of the Reading Viaduct Project here in Philadelphia. And Isaiah Thompson is a writer, investigative reporter for the Philadelphia City Paper. And we are talking both about New York and about Philadelphia and these parks in the sky, as some of these high lines have been called. Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And we have David from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. And David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I have a quick question and a quick comment, if I may. As a listener not familiar with the project, my quick question would be, can one of the speakers talk to, you know, some of the nitty-gritty facts that make it easier for a layperson to understand? How many acres of open space would this add to Philadelphia, or how much rainwater would this mitigate to stop flooding that affects many of our neighborhoods? So if one of the speakers maybe could talk to that issue, that would be great. And my quick comment related to one of the speakers talking about the economic value, the Green Space Alliance and the Economy League of Greater Philadelphia actually did a study showing billions of dollars in potential economic value from more open spaces right here in the Delaware Valley, including highlighting some parks in Philadelphia. So I would hope that the listeners and speakers take a look at that report at greenspacealliance.org.
Okay, fair enough, David. I do want to keep us focused on the Reading Viaduct. And perhaps to you, John Struble, some more specifics about this project. Can you fill in some of the blanks?
Specifically, to answer David's question, it runs about 3/4 of a mile. It's about 5 acres total. And so I can't speak much about the runoff and that sort of thing, but I guess it does have something to do with that. Also, I'd like to say, if he would like to learn more, on November 15th at 6 o'clock at the Academy of Sciences, there's going to be a conference about the Reading Viaduct where they can see some of the plans, and there'll be some other speakers there to talk about the urban sustainability. So there'll be a speech that night at 6 o'clock on November 15th.
Isaiah, let me go back to you. And we're talking about property here in Philadelphia. Who owns, is the Reading Railroad Company still own this viaduct?
Yeah, it's a really complicated situation. SEPTA, I believe, owns part of it, and then the Reading Railroad Company owns part of it, which, this is really bizarre. I didn't know this. Did you know that the Reading Railroad is now in the movie production business? Yeah,
no.
It's like in Hollywood now or something. So, very weird. Very strange. John might know more about that.
I could speak to that.
Yeah. Okay, good.
If you'd like.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
The what we call the 9th Street branch, which is the one that runs directly north, is owned by Reading International, Inc., which is correctly located in California, and they own movie theaters in Australia and New Zealand. And I think in the 90s they bought a bankrupt railroad. They were under another name, and they took the name of it, so they basically bought the Reading when they were doing something else, and they own the Reading Railroad, and then they own also a lot of other parcels of land here in Philadelphia and other parts of Pennsylvania. They also owe the city some back taxes, and they are talking with the city now. I think the discussion started earlier in the summer. I don't know how they're going, but I think they're at least they're talking. Up until this point, there was not much discussion, and this is what our advocacy is all about, is have the city of Philadelphia talk to Reading and try to get together on passing ownership of their part of the viaduct. The other part of the viaduct that forks off to the west is the SEPTA loop, and that's owned by SEPTA.
All right, well, we're going to take another short break, get back to our conversation, and that's John Struble. He's a furniture maker here in Philadelphia and is co-founder of the Reading Viaduct Project. Joshua David also joining us by telephone, talking about the High Line in New York, and Isaiah Thompson here with us in our Philadelphia studios. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Yannick Neige-Séguin, the next music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducts Italian-inspired classics. Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony, Tchaikovsky's Francesca da Rimini, and Respighi's The Pines of Rome, with brass blazing from the four corners of the Kimmel Center. 215-893-1999 for tickets. Online, philorc.org, November 10th, 11th, and 12th. Yannick Neige-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Are there too many administrators in higher education? A professor says yes, and the layers of bureaucracy come at the expense of learning. Also, backbone in fracking, new words for the new American Heritage Dictionary. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Christiana Care Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, Christiana Care cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year. And the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. Christiana Care, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. The Reading Railroad Viaduct that runs through Callow Hill and Chinatown North neighborhoods in Philadelphia has fallen into disrepair. And there are some plans, or people thinking about plans, to turn it into a park modeled in part on the successful High Line in Manhattan. And again, Joshua David, one of the masterminds behind the High Line, is with us by telephone. And he has co-authored a book with his partner, Robert Hammond. And the book is called High Line, the Inside Story of New York City's Park in the Sky. John Struble is a supporter, wants to turn the Reading Viaduct into a park. Isaiah Thompson has been writing about all of this for the Philadelphia City Paper. And we've got a full bank of calls, and I do want to get to our callers. But let me go very quickly to you, if I could, Josh. The High Line has been operational, what, for a couple of years now?
And June 2009.
Since June 2009. Are you surprised about how people use it?
It's amazing to see how people use it. It's I think, you know, it is a linear park on an old rail track, 30 feet in the air, running through the middle of city blocks. And so I think there's a thought that people are going to use it as a path or a way to get from one way to another. But it's really also an incredibly social place where people go up to gather and hang out and go on dates and bring their families and look at the amazing horticulture up there. And you can really see the city from an entirely different perspective than you can just 30 feet below on the ground. And there's really a very similar quality on the Reading Viaduct. Obviously, Philadelphia and New York are different in many ways, but the views from up there are spectacular, and I think it really does have the opportunity in Philadelphia to be something equal, if somewhat different, from what we've done in New York.
And looking back, would you redesign it in any way?
I think there's, from a design point of view, there's very little that we would do differently. It's really been an extraordinary success, and so what we're really focused on now is moving on to the third section. We're only two thirds done. We have our biggest final section to go around the West Side rail yards, going up to 34th Street. So that's just beginning to get off the ground right now. We had some good news on that yesterday, in that the city and the developers working on that site have all come to a basic agreement that the High Line will be preserved on that site and go forward up to 34th Street.
And what's been the cost so far?
The cost so far has been $150 million.
Does that seem about right? Is that what you thought it would be?
It's a little bit more than we thought it would be, but we were able to the vision behind this project was so exciting to so many different people that we found it. It's never easy to raise money, but when you have a really compelling vision for something that's going to change the face of the city for generations to come, you find that both elected officials with access to public monies and private philanthropists who really want to make an impact on their city find ways to come forward. We've just completed a $50 million private capital campaign and are entering our next phase of that.
Let me get to Robert from North Chinatown to join our conversation. And Robert, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Yeah, I'm an artist, and I'm one of 90 artists in a loft building at 10th and Spring Garden Street, roughly, mm-hmm. and the High Line runs right beside us, or the elevated Reading. And, you know, we're concerned about what's going to happen. We think this is a worthy project, but, you know, there are winners and there are losers, and certainly when the elevated park is built, we see ourselves as losers. We come from all over the region, not just the city, mm-hmm. and so we don't have direct representation. Many of us, but we wonder what your guests have in their vision for, an artist. This is an artist loft building. It's an old Reading depot building. What happens to us when the elevated park is built and is successful?
It's a fair question. I'm going to toss that to John Strubel. John, go ahead.
I really don't know how to answer that. I think if, hopefully they'll be able to stay there. I don't really know how to answer that. If your own property in the neighborhood, you can be on the management association of the NID, but the future is pretty much wide open as far as I can see.
May I just throw something?
Yeah, go ahead,
Josh. So we encountered a similar kind of issue in the Highline neighborhood. There were a lot of galleries and artist studios in the Highline neighborhood. And one of the things that the city did when it was doing the planning around the Highline under the leadership of Amanda Burden, the chair of our planning commission, was that they looked at different zones around the Highline, and not all zones were allowed to be redeveloped as residential property. A lot of the zoning around the Highline was manufacturing based, and that's where the galleries and artist studios were. They were in spaces that had been zoned for manufacturing uses. And by retaining that zoning requirement on the space, essentially new residential construction, the most lucrative type of real estate development, couldn't happen in those in the areas that the artists were most heavily located. And what it's done is it's led to the preservation of a really important cultural community in New York City, one of the biggest art gallery meccas in the world.
Robert, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Isaiah, do you want to weigh in on that? I mean, what we hear, and I think Robert's concerns should be addressed by somebody, and of course people don't know the future exactly, but nonetheless, there are people with stake in this property.
Yeah, and I certainly don't know the future either, but I guess what I would say is, it's interesting. This project is still in very early. I mean, this is still just an idea, a dream with, now kind of a study behind it. So we're still very early in the process of creating this thing, if that ever happens. But what is not a dream, and what is not just an idea, is this district, this special assessment district. So, I don't know the answer to the caller's question, but I think that part of, there's a lot of time to discuss what the caller is asking about. There is not a lot of time if the Councilman DiCicco, who is on his way out of City Council, is going to pass this through City Council. There's not a lot of time to talk about that. So,
and this is the NID that we've been talking about.
Correct. This is the Neighborhood Improvement District, yeah.
John, a quick question for you. If this park were to come to be, what would the cost be?
You're asking me?
I am.
I think there was one study said it would be around $35 million. I would like to back up a little bit. There is, when I was talking about the 9th Street branch and the SEPTA spur, which goes from Callahill Street over to Broad Street, the SEPTA spur, because SEPTA is in Philadelphia, there's been discussions with them, and there's actually preliminary schematic designs being made right now for that particular part.
Fair enough. Let me get Jeff from, it looks like, Queen Village to join our conversation. And Jeff, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Hi, Isaiah. Hi, John. Having been up on the High Line with Sarah and John, on the Reading Viaduct with Sarah and John, it's a great, great project. I think it's got incredible potential to revitalize that part of the city. I think, just to sort of piggyback on what Isaiah was just saying, I think the big problem here is this NID. It's a novel idea, but it's going to tax residences in perpetuity for services that they feel the city should be providing. So to me, I think there needed to have been a conversation that brought together all parties much earlier, brought together Chinatown, brought together Callahill North, and I think there's a bit of a failure of leadership, and I think leaving this NID as a legacy is probably a bad idea. I would strongly urge council to sort of table this until those conversations happen.
Okay, fair enough.
Jeff,
go ahead, John.
The authorization is only for 5 years. It's not forever.
In perpetuity.
Right.
Do you want to weigh in on that, Isaiah, at all?
Well, I'm not here to give my opinion on the NID or not, but I would say that it is correct that this came up fairly quickly, and because you do have the pressure, you have a councilman, you know, the representative of that neighborhood is on his way out of city council and appears to be trying to get this done before he leaves. That's really not very much time. So I think it is an accurate observation that this component of, you know, I don't even want to say of the project, because mm-hmm. there's debate over whether it has anything to do with the park or not. But that component has happened much more quickly than the other sort of timeframes we're looking at. And it is certainly true that there are a lot of people who feel that there has not been, you know, widespread community buy-in, and that they are not have not been part of the process.
Josh, let me go back to you and even go back to the High Line in New York. And I haven't walked the new section, but I walked the original section. I'm interested in the kind of materials that you used and how you thought about the kind of plants and trees and shrubbery that would grow in that kind of urban environment.
Yeah, the environment on the High Line, the park that we built, was really inspired by the way that nature took over the tracks after the train stopped running. There was just gravel ballast up there, but nature is a very powerful thing, and even though there was no soil material, over the course of 20 years, this very lush natural landscape grew up there, and that was our inspiration. And so we, in 2004, selected a design team, James Corner Field Operations, who actually is at Penn,
exactly.
And Diller Scifidio and Renfro and the Dutch horticulturist Pete Udolf came up with a design that was very reflective of this naturalistic landscape that had taken over the High Line, but allowed public access. It's essentially a paving system of walkway of cement planks that break apart at their edges to allow the plants to push up through them, very much the same way that the plants pushed up through the gravel ballast of the High Line. So it's a very unusual park landscape. It feels a lot like the original High Line landscape, but it's able to accommodate very heavy levels of public use, which we're getting right now. We're right now per square foot by far the most heavily visited park in New York City.
And I've seen people sunbathing at the High Line.
Yeah, we've got all of these great seating opportunities. There are these big benches on a space called the Diller von Furstenberg Sun Deck, which overlooks the river. Mm-hmm. And so they're always, on a nice day, they're always full with people sunbathing. And then we have another sort of amphitheater structure that steps down. It's called the 10th Avenue Square, where it crosses 10th Avenue, and you can watch the traffic flowing underneath through these big glass windows. And it turns the life of the street below you really into a ballet of sorts. And people love to just sit on those wooden deck amphitheater benches and just watch the life of the city below them.
Let me get, looks like Maria Yen to join us from Chinatown. And Maria, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, my name is Maria Yen, and I'm one of the people that's leading the opposition to this NID.
Yes.
Just want to put it simply, this is a perfect example of taxation without representation. I do not oppose to the whole concept of NID, but the fact that top 20% of the business within NID will be carrying the 50% of the gross tax, and also the fact that majority of us were in the dark and that we were not inclusive. Now, the group, Telehu Neighbor Association, is trying to say that they were including, or they're the majority, but the plain fact is, if you look at the makeup of the group at the hearing, which was televised live, you will see that they are not representation of our neighborhood. The boundary of the zone of the NID is what we represent. We are not made of just Asian Americans. We are made up of Jewish, Italian, Irish, Arab, Greek. We are made up of all these people who believe that Calhoun neighborhood was not, democratic in a sense of how they went about creating this bill and how the DiCicco's office went about creating this bill.
Well,
this
Maria, let me just stop you there because I want to give John Struble a chance to weigh in on that. John, go ahead.
I think this is the NID has sort of turned out to be like trying to build a new school out in Chester County. You're going to get the pluses and the minuses, you know, the people for it and against it. I don't see this neighborhood. I don't see this as us against them sort of thing. I think the crime goes down when you have an improvement district. And we just think that we're active in the neighborhood. We reached out considerably to all our neighbors. We have stuff translated into Chinese that we passed out. So if somebody didn't hear about it, I'm surprised. I don't think it's from our lack of outreach. And as you go forward from now, they do still have an opportunity. They have 45 days to vote to express their opposition in writing to the city council. If they get 51% opposed in the neighborhood, then the NID dies. That's the end of it.
Isaiah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I've met Ms. Yen in city council, and you know, I just recall, I think it was the first hearing on this, Ms. Yen had said that, I believe it was Ms. Yen, that they had already collected 50-some percent, and that this was before part of that neighborhood got cut out of it. You know, and I've spoken with people since who say that they're close to getting a majority again. And I do think that you have to ask, if that's accurate, if they've really collected close to that many signatures, you know, how do you, you know, do you really want to pass something where slightly less than half of the neighborhood supports it? So I think that's it's an important question. And what I would also say is that, you know, what's interesting about the way this is set up is that the burden falls on those opposed to sort of collect all these signatures if this passes, whereas a single council person, because the way city council works, if a district council person wants something, in general, the whole rest of the body says, okay. So, you know, it creates an interesting situation where the people opposed to this, in a certain sense, at this point now, have a greater burden to stop it. Mm. And you know, I think that's something to look at.
Josh, we're almost out of time here, but we've been focusing on New York and Philadelphia. Are there other cities that are looking at Highline type projects?
Yeah, Chicago has a project called the Bloomingdale Trail, there's a project in Jersey City called the Embankment, and then there are other related projects all over the country: St. Louis, Seattle, Los Angeles, all sorts of things that are maybe less directly related. But what I'd say is somebody who's been up on the Reading Viaduct. And members of our staff have toured. I think it's what John referred to as the SEPTA branch, but there's another branch where that's connected that goes actually down to ground and then underground or in a cut.
The submersive part.
And I think they have another organization called Viaduct Green. I know our horticultural staff went there and viewed it and thought it was just another amazing opportunity in Philadelphia. I don't know the politics of this NID, so I can't really comment on that. But you know, I just urge the city to really take a good look at this project. There are opportunities like this only come up every once in a while.
Well, I hate to do this.
Yeah.
More to be continued for sure. But Joshua David, thank you for joining us today, Radio Times. And John Struble, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And Isaiah Thompson, thanks for stopping in as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. And go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times.